The end of the Cold War was the greatest shock to international affairs since World War II. In that perilous moment, Saddam Hussein chose to invade Kuwait. China cracked down on its own pro-democracy protesters, and regimes throughout Eastern Europe teetered between democratic change and new authoritarians. Not since FDR in 1945 had a U.S. president faced such opportunities and challenges. So says presidential historian Jeffrey Engel in his new book, When the World Seemed New, George H.W. Bush and the End of the Cold War, where he reveals what happened behind closed doors from the Oval Office to the Kremlin. Distrusted by key allies such as Margaret Thatcher and dismissed as too cautious by the press, Engel says Bush had the experience and the wisdom to use personal one-on-one diplomacy with world leaders. Jeffrey Engel is the founding director of the Center for Presidential History at Southern Methodist University. Again, the name of the new book is When the World Seemed New, and we welcome Jeffrey Engel to the roundtable this morning. Jeffrey, thank you very much for being with us.
Oh, my pleasure. Good to talk to you.
Good to talk to you. What brought you to the subject of wanting to look at that time of the end of the Cold War and how this particular president handled it?
You know, to be honest, I came at it rather coincidentally. I was teaching at Texas A&M University. It was my first job out of, a full-time job out of graduate school, and had just finished my first book, which was on aviation technology during the Cold War. And my department chair said, you know, there's a book over in the library you should check out. It's actually a diary. It turns out to be George H.W. Bush's diary from his time when he was in China. And of course, the Bush Presidential Library is located on that campus, so it's 300 yards away from my office. And the more I read into that diary, the more I read about Bush, the more I read about the end of the Cold War, I realized that there was a fascinating story here to be told, frankly, about just how lucky we were to have survived the entire experience.
You use this phrase several times, or give this idea of that Bush, in his management of this, President Bush, was very calm in a very tumultuous end of a very long tumultuous era.
Yes, I think we, you know, to understand the difficulties of the end of the Cold War, I think we really need to forget, first of all, that it turned out quite so well, because we think back on it now as a time of democratic expansion, as a time of celebration, as almost a time of utopianism. We should remember instead that rarely, if ever, in history, in fact, really never in history, has a great power collapsed without an ensuing great power war. And certainly never have we run that experiment as a globe with nuclear weapons involved. So the fact that the Soviet Union was breaking up, and we, of course, see the ethnic tensions, the religious tensions, the linguistic tensions that occurred in its aftermath, and the fact that we have crowds in Budapest and in Berlin and throughout Eastern Europe essentially marching on their own well-armed governments, and the fact that none of those turned into a violent bloodbath, frankly, like we saw in Tiananmen Square, and who knows where that bloodbath may have led, is really remarkable. And one of the things that I think President Bush is going to get credit for is the behind-the-scenes ways in which he talked to foreign leaders, calmed foreign leaders, wrote letters to foreign leaders to try to make sure that everybody essentially kept calm during this period when, frankly, chaos seemed to be breaking out.
So give us a sense of how you see this as a continuation of the policies of Ronald Reagan, Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall, to President George H.W. Bush and his own way of dealing with this. What was the differentiation there?
There's two critical points, and the first is I think going to make many of your listeners uncomfortable, which is to say that the more we understand about the end of the Cold War, the more I study the end of the Cold War, I'm more and more convinced not only that Ronald Reagan played less of a role, if not any role, than we thought, but also that the United States in many ways played less of a role than we thought. The real structural changes that occurred before ending the Cold War took place on the Soviet side. It took place well before Reagan even took office in the late 1970s. Soviet officials were well aware that their system wasn't working and needed to change. That's before Reagan even entered the White House. And that period of change that finally culminated in the ascension to power in 1985 of Mikhail Gorbachev was really a recognition not only that they needed to change, but that they had no choice but to change. And of course, one of the difficulties that Reagan faced, and one of the things where I think he gets a lot of credit, is whether or not we should trust this new guy in the Kremlin who is saying we're going to do things completely differently. Reagan chose to trust. Bush, coming in his wake, was frankly a lot less trusting. He wanted to see what it was that Gorbachev would do and not just listen to his words. It's sort of ironic that we always associate Reagan with the term trust but verify, but it turns out it was Bush who actually put that into practice.
You talk in the book about how when he's faced with this instability, the instinct is to do no harm, to be rather quiet, to sort of watch and see what happens.
Yes, and to really appreciate why Bush took that approach, one has to take a sort of a 30,000-foot view of what he thought as a person, what he thought as a citizen, what he thought as a president. And frankly, this is both a credit and a criticism. He is a person who believed fundamentally that American democracy, American values, American-style free market were working and would work and would continue to work, and that all the rest of the world needed to do was to accept just how right we were and everything would be rosy in the future going forward. And he saw the end of the Cold War as basically validation of everything that he had already believed. Now, I think there's room to criticize him here in that he did not necessarily go too terribly deep into pondering whether or not other countries would really want to turn towards American-style democracy. But when he was president and he saw the world essentially moving his way, moving towards democracy, moving in the way that American leadership had always hoped, his response was, well, if everything's going in the right way, let's just make sure we keep going in the right way. Let's not rock the boat. Let's not paddle too hard with the current. If you're winning, the first solution is keep winning. So whenever a crisis arose, he essentially wanted to make sure that we played the long game, because in his opinion, the long game would most likely lead to not only a peaceful world, but also an expansion of an American-led democratic movement.
And you talk about, you mentioned Tiananmen Square, and that's what he feared, right? I mean, that was what he was worried about happening.
Yeah, we really don't have to look far at all to see the great nightmare scenario for Bush in Europe. And of course, we have to remember that the 1980s and 1990s was not the first time that Eastern Europeans had tried to exercise a little bit more autonomy from the Soviets. And every time previously, whether it's 1953 with East Germany, whether it's 1956 in Hungary, whether it's 1968 in Czechoslovakia, or 1981 in Poland, every time that indigenous nationalist movements tried to break away from the Soviets, frankly, the Soviets subsequently sent in tanks and mowed down the crowds. And there was a great fear that that would not only happen again in Eastern Europe, but we had just witnessed that happening in Tiananmen Square. And so Bush's fear was that what happened in Tiananmen would replicate itself in Eastern Europe. But Bush's hope in many ways was that Tiananmen would in fact be more of a speed bump, if you will, than a complete obstacle or than a reverse course for China in particular. Because, again, he believed the world was moving in a democratic fashion. And he believed China in particular was moving in a democratic fashion because of its engagement with the outside world after 10 years of Deng Xiaoping's policies and after the Cultural Revolution. So given that the democratic movement that spawned Tiananmen Square was the product of engagement, Bush's long-term solution after Tiananmen Square was, yes, to condemn, but also to try to ensure that China remained engaged in the world, that would lead to the best outcome a generation forward.
What do you think his greatest accomplishments were during this time?
You know, to me, there's no doubt. Most people, I think, would answer that question by saying, you know, leadership during the Gulf War, which, you know, in many ways is the Iraq War that is, if nothing else, more fondly remembered these days, if you will. But I think the real answer to that is the unification of Germany. Remember, Germany, of course, was divided after 1945 into two separate states. And to be honest, nobody really expected the Berlin Wall to come down. Nobody really expected East Germany's government to crumble as quickly and in the fast way that it did, which left essentially a power vacuum in Europe where all of Europe's leaders were concerned, how is this going to play out? And frankly, they all had long memories that the last time the Germans had been together had been World War II, so that didn't necessarily turn out well for the rest of Europe. So in a nutshell, every single major leader in Europe except Helmut Kohl in Germany was against German unification. But Bush was in favor of it. And he was in favor of it for a very simple reason. The simple reason is he believed that the United States needed to remain engaged and involved in Europe, that war had not broken out in Europe since we were engaged and involved. And the only way for us to keep involved in Europe was to keep NATO alive. And the only way to keep NATO alive was to make sure the Germans were in it. So he cut a deal, essentially, with Helmut Kohl, saying, you can unify. I will, as the President of the United States, ensure that you can unify. You just have to stay in NATO. And so in that sense, I think he really is the behind-the-scenes father of the new country.
So what went wrong in the sense that he came to be a one-term president and also was linked to the Gulf War, which was seen by many as a job that was not finished and the mission was not accomplished?
Well, let me take the Gulf War first. I love to recall a line that James Baker, who was Bush's Secretary of State, employed right around 2006. He said, you know, people used to ask me why we didn't go to Baghdad, why we didn't occupy all of Iraq, why we didn't turn it into a democracy, why we didn't essentially engage fully and stay there after we had won the Gulf War. He said, you know, right around 2005, 2006, people stopped asking me that. And it became clear that all the things that the first Bush administration, the George H.W. Bush administration, feared might occur with an occupation of Iraq, drumming up national sentiment, a religious civil war, great despair for America and its allies, and the people of Iraq, all they feared would come true if they had occupied in 91, which is why they chose not to do it. In terms of his own election, there's a sense in which you could say that Bush did his job too well. He was elected in 1988 by a public that was concerned about the international scene, concerned about what the end of the Cold War and Gorbachev's changes might mean. And frankly, after 3.5 years of being successful as a diplomat, the world seemed to be going pretty well. The world seemed to be new and going our way. And the American public said, well, we don't really need an experienced diplomat. We need somebody who's more focused on the domestic issues that we now care more about. And Bush, with a reputation for being a diplomat first, was not the choice for 1992.
What do you think the long-term legacy will be of that time and of the president?
You know, I think the long-term legacy is that we are frankly just seeing such an incredible degradation of the typical norms and respect for the office of the presidency in our country that begins well before Donald Trump, though clearly he has catalyzed and exacerbated it. I think that we're going to look back on George H.W. Bush and not only see a competent man and a longtime public servant, and not only see a man who was willing in many ways to do things in the national interest that he knew were going to hurt his poll numbers, but most fundamentally, even Bush's critics at the time didn't despise and hate him in the way that subsequent people despised and hated Bill Clinton, George W. Bush, Barack Obama, and now Donald Trump. The word hate was not really associated with criticism of George H.W. Bush. People disagreed, but there wasn't that visceral disdain. So I think when we look back on his time period, we're going to look back, and it really is maybe the last period where we had not so much bipartisanship, but a sense of civility in Washington's politics.
So I assume it's not a surprise to you at all that in another book about George H.W. Bush that he refers to the current president as a blowhard.
No, that doesn't surprise me in the least, because Bush recognized above all else that as the president of the United States, you essentially are the CEO of the world's biggest corporation in many ways, which means you have to take a lot of advice and you need to think carefully when you speak and you need to listen to other people and try to be the president not just of your party or not even just your wing of your party, but for the entire country and ipso facto for the entire world. I think he sees none of those things in Donald Trump. He's a man who doesn't seem to respect the opinion of others, even those around him, which to Bush is just entirely anathema to how good governments is done.
The name of the book is When the World Seemed New, George H.W. Bush and the End of the Cold War. It is published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. Jeffrey Engel, a great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you very much for sharing with us.
Good to talk to you. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Again, the name of the book is When the World Seemed New, published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.